This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Inside the Tornado, Marketing Strategies from Silicon Valley's Cutting Edge. Written and read by Jeffrey Moore. Remember the beginning of Wizard of Oz? Dorothy and Toto are caught up inside a tornado, swept away from their mundane world of Kansas, and deposited into the marvelous land of Oz. Well, this miraculous form of ascension is also reenacted from time to time on our own public stock exchanges. Consider the following. Compaq Computers, which in recent years has overtaken IBM as the leader of the Intel-based PC market, grew from $0 to $1 billion in less than 5 years. Ditto for Connor Peripherals, a disk drive storage company who slipstreamed Compaq's hypergrowth by supplying it, as well as many of its competitors, with low-cost Winchester hard drives. For the entire decade of the 1980s, Oracle Corporation grew at an annually compounded rate of 100%. And finally, Microsoft, in less than 15 years, has grown from a boutique language software company focused on BASIC to the richest and most powerful software company in the world. Such are the market forces generated by discontinuous innovations, or what more recently have been termed paradigm shifts. These shifts begin with the appearance of a new category of product that incorporates breakthrough technology enabling unprecedented benefits. It is immediately proposed as the natural replacement for a whole class of infrastructure, winning early converts and enthusiastic predictions of a new world order. But the market is a conservative institution, and it presses back against the new changes, preferring to stay with the status quo. For a long time, although much is written about the new paradigm, little of economic significance happens. But in many cases, there then comes a flashpoint of change when the entire marketplace, under the pressure of continually escalating disequilibrium in price performance, shifts its allegiance from the old architecture to the new. This sequence of events unleashes a vortex of market demand. Infrastructure, to be useful, must be standard and global. So once the market moves to switch out the old for the new, it wants to complete this transition as rapidly as possible. All the pent-up interest in the product is thus converted into a massive purchasing binge, causing demand to vastly outstrip supply. Companies grow at hyper-growth rates, with billions of dollars of revenue seeming to appear from out of nowhere. As members of a market, our behavior is invariable. We move as a herd. We mill and mill and mill around, and then all of a sudden, we stampede. And that is what creates the tornado. Nowhere has the tornado touched down more often in the past quarter century than in the computer and electronics industry. In the domain of business computing, it began with the proliferation of IBM mainframes, which won worldwide support as the first major computing infrastructure standard. Then, in the space of less than a decade, beginning in the late 1970s, three new architectures arose to challenge and displace the paradigm: the mini computer, the personal computer, and the technical workstation. In conjunction with these three architectures came a communications networking paradigm shift that moved from the centralized hub-and-spokes approach of the mainframe-centric computing to the decentralized world of local area networks interconnected via wide area networks. And concurrent with both these shifts, virtually all of our software, from the underlying operating systems to the databases to the applications and the tools that build them, was overthrown or reworked, in most cases more than once. By the end of the decade, microprocessor-based systems will increase 10 times in power every 2.5 years, and there is no foreseeable end in sight. this phenomenon has an extraordinarily destabilizing effect on every industry within the high-tech sector. All high-tech products ultimately take their value from software, and the software written at any point in time must work within the power constraints of the current, soon-to-be-shipped hardware. But after only a few short years, another order of magnitude of additional power comes on the scene, making these same design constraints obsolete. For those who work within the high-tech sector, or who manage investments in these companies, this imperative translates into a series of deceptively simple questions. What can we do during a tornado to best capitalize on our opportunities? How can we tell when one is coming, and what can we do to prepare? How can we sense when one is ending, and what should we do then? And finally, how can we reframe our strategic management concepts to better accommodate tornado market dynamics in general? It is the intent of this recording to answer these questions in some detail, and to do so specifically in the context of examples drawn from current developments in the high-tech sector. Virtually all contemporary thinking about high-tech marketing strategy has its roots in the technology adoption lifecycle, a model which grew out of social research begun in the late 1950s about how communities respond to discontinuous innovations. Truly discontinuous innovations are new products or services that require the end user and the marketplace to dramatically change their past behavior, with the promise of gaining equally dramatic new benefits. Applied to marketing, the model postulates that when a marketplace is confronted with the opportunity to switch to a new infrastructure paradigm, from typewriters, say, to word processors, customers self-segregate along an axis of risk aversion, with the risk-immune innovators moving to the forefront, asking, even demanding, to be the first to try out the new opportunity, while the risk-allergic laggards retreat to the rear of the line. In between, the model identifies three additional communities: the early adopters, the early majority, and the later majority. When the technology adoption lifecycle came upon the scene, we were delighted because it helped us explain why our communications got such enthusiastic responses from some customers and such chilly ones from others. In order to make this model truly ours, we relabeled each of the five constituencies as follows. 1. Innovators are technology enthusiasts. These are the people who are fundamentally committed to new technology on the grounds that, sooner or later, it is bound to improve our lives. Moreover, they take pleasure in mastering its intricacies, just in fiddling with it, and they love to get their hands on the latest and greatest innovation. And thus, they are typically the first customers for anything that is truly brand new. From a marketing point of view, particularly in business-to-business sales, there is really only one drawback to techies. They don't have any money. What they have instead is influence. The reason we spend so much time with them is that they are the gatekeepers to the rest of the life cycle. If they pan a new product, no one else gives that product a second glance. Only with their endorsement can a discontinuous innovation get a hearing, and so we often seed or give products to this community to gain their support. 2. Early adopters are visionaries. These are the true revolutionaries in business and government who want to use the discontinuity of any innovation to make a break with the past and start an entirely new future. Visionaries have an extraordinary influence on high tech because they are the first constituency who can and will bring real money to the table. In doing so, they provide at least as much seed funding for entrepreneurs as does the venture capital community. And because they tend to love the limelight, they also help publicize the new innovation, giving it a necessary boost to succeed in the early market. 3. The early majority are the pragmatists. These people make the bulk of all technology infrastructure purchases. They do not love technology for its own sake, and so they are different from the techies, whom they are careful nonetheless to employ. Moreover, they believe in evolution, not revolution, so they are not visionaries either. Indeed, they shy away from them. Instead, they are interested in making their company's systems work effectively. So they are neutral about technology, and they look to adopt innovations only after a proven track record of useful productivity improvement, including strong references from people they trust. Pragmatists prefer to buy from the market leader for two reasons. First, everyone in the market makes their products work with the leader's. So while the leader's product may not be the best one, systems built upon it are going to be the most reliable. And second, the market leader attracts many third-party companies into its aftermarket, so that even when the leader is not responsive to customer requests, the marketplace as a whole is. As a result, pragmatists have determined that customers of market-leading vendors get a better overall value from the market. 4. The late majority are the conservative. These customers are pessimistic about their ability to gain any value from technology investments and undertake them only under duress, typically because the remaining alternative is to let the rest of the world pass them by. They are very price-sensitive, highly skeptical, and very demanding. Rarely do they get their demands met, in part because they are unwilling to pay for any extra services, all of which only reconfirms their sour views of high tech. Conservatives, nonetheless, represent a largely untapped opportunity for high tech products, holding out the promise of a horde of new customers who can be brought into the market if they are handled with care, albeit presenting deep challenges to vendors who elect to serve them. And finally, 5, the laggards are the skeptics. These are the gadflies of high tech, the ones who delight in challenging the hype and puffery of high tech marketing. They are not so much potential customers as ever-present critics. As such, the goal of high-tech marketing is not to sell to them, but rather to sell around them. Linked all together, these 5 profiles make up the technology adoption life cycle. The idea of developing the market by working from one profile to the next provided the basis for high-tech marketing strategy in the 1980s. Unfortunately, as logical and attractive as this strategy appeared in theory, in actual practice, it did not work very often. Specifically, companies kept stumbling every time it came to making the transition from the visionaries to the pragmatists. The problem was, these two groups, although adjacent on the adoption lifecycle, are so different in terms of underlying values as to make communication between them almost impossible. Visionaries with their highly innovative projects do not make good references for pragmatists, and market development, instead of gliding across this transition point, stalls. Unfortunately, by the time that high-tech firms were getting this far into the market, they were so highly leveraged financially that any hiccup would throw them into a tailspin, or, as we came to call it, into the chasm. The idea of the chasm is a simple one. It says that whenever truly innovative high-tech products are first brought to market, they will initially enjoy a warm welcome in an early market made up of technology enthusiasts and visionaries, but then will fall into a chasm during which sales will falter and often plummet. If the products can successfully cross this chasm, they will gain acceptance within a mainstream market dominated by pragmatists and conservatives. Since for product-oriented enterprises, virtually all high-tech wealth comes from this third phase of market development, crossing the chasm becomes an organizational imperative. Unfortunately, too few innovative products were actually getting across. What was happening instead was that investors, flushed with the results of early market acceptance, became impatient to see an immediate transition into a high-growth, high-profit mainstream marketplace. That, after all, was what the life cycle model predicted. When they got chasm results instead, they assumed that management was somehow at fault. And in trying to correct these faults, they ended up more often than not destabilizing operations to a point from which they could never recover. Fortunately, as the chasm idea has caught on, this is all beginning to change. The fundamental strategy for making a successful crossing is based on a single observation. The main difference between the visionaries of the early market and the pragmatists in the mainstream is that the former are willing to bet on the come, whereas the latter want to see solutions in production before they buy. That is, when a visionary sees that you have 80% of the solution to her problem, she says, "Great, let's get started right away on building the other 20% together." A pragmatist, on the other hand, says, "Wait a minute, aren't you supposed to be the one improving my productivity? I'll buy this thing when it's done, but not before." Specifically, what pragmatists want, more than anything else, is a 100% solution to their problem, what we came to call the whole product. In the context of the chasm, the whole product is defined as the minimum set of products and services necessary to ensure that the target customer will achieve his or her compelling reason to buy. High-tech companies were prolonging their stays in the chasm because they were unable or unwilling to commit to taking any particular whole product all the way through to this level of completion. Here's what would happen instead. The high-tech enterprise, sensing it was in the chasm and realizing the customer needed more than just the bare product itself, would set out to address this problem. Instead of focusing on a single target customer, however, management would invariably recoil from putting all its eggs in one basket. Instead, it would target 4 or 5 likely candidate segments with the idea of focusing intensively on whichever opportunity caught fire first. This decision was followed by a round of customer visits with major customers from each of the target segments, during which wish lists of requirements were painstakingly extracted and recorded. These lists were then reviewed by a product marketing council made up of marketing and engineering managers who would extract from them the common themes, the most broadly requested enhancements. These were the nuggets, or the key requirements, which defined the next release. In this way, when the next release came out, true to its intent, it had something for everybody. Unfortunately, however, it had everything for nobody. That is, no one group ever got 100% of its whole product requirements fulfilled. We never finished any one customer's list. But that is precisely the requirement that pragmatists insist upon before they purchase. Pragmatists, therefore, would praise our efforts, pat us on the back, but they would not buy our product. It was only then that some of us came to the counterintuitive, indeed horrifying, realization that the only safe way to cross the chasm is in fact to put all your eggs in one basket. The key to a winning strategy is to identify a single beachhead of pragmatist customers in a mainstream market segment and to accelerate the formation of 100% of their whole product. The goal is to win a niche foothold in the mainstream as quickly as possible. That is what is meant by crossing the chasm. Inside the Tornado is focused on mapping the marketplace beyond the chasm. It focuses on 4 subsequent stages in the life cycle model. The bowling alley, a period of niche-based adoption in advance of the general marketplace, driven by compelling customer needs and the willingness of vendors to craft niche-specific whole products. The Tornado, a period of mass market adoption when the general marketplace switches over to the new infrastructure paradigm. Main Street, a period of aftermarket development, when the base infrastructure has been deployed and the goal now is to flesh out its potential. And finally, End of Life, which can come all too soon in high tech, because of the semiconductor engine driving price performance to unheard-of levels, enabling wholly new paradigms to come to market and supplant the leaders who themselves had only just arrived. For Dorothy to get to the Emerald City of Oz, she had to journey through a number of strange lands. And just so for the high-tech enterprise, which, having left the chasm and established itself on a beachhead, is now invited to proceed further into a bowling alley? Well, yes, if only to make a point. The bowling alley represents that part of the technology adoption lifecycle in which a new product gains acceptance from niches within the mainstream market, but has yet to achieve general widespread adoption. The goal of bowling alley marketing is to keep moving toward the tornado, to progress from niche to niche, developing momentum. During this stage of the adoption lifecycle, the general populace does not actually adopt the new paradigm, but it does get exposure to it. This helps soften up the mainstream market to participate at a later date in the hypergrowth of the tornado. But there is still great benefit in the present moment because bowling alley niche markets represent profitable, repeatable business, and entrepreneurial enterprises can therefore fund themselves for the first time out of working capital, focusing on the discipline of making a profit and continuing to enhance and cost-reduce their offerings for future expansion. Niches at this stage of the market are not large enough to support multiple vendors, nor are they comfortable doing so. They want instead to rally around a single vendor who has a highly application-specific solution tailored to their particular issues. You must expel all other competitors and establish yourself as the dominant market leader. This is not as hard as it may seem. By definition, given where you are in the life cycle, you have a terrifically innovative product. All you have to do is focus it on a segment of customers who have a compelling reason to buy, some pressing need that they are currently unable to fulfill. You enable these customers by committing to finish their wish list, completing their particular whole product, in return for which they give you their business. And once enough of them do that, word gets around that there is this company out there with a great new approach, and then they all give you their business. This same word-of-mouth mechanism also works to ward off any late-coming competitors because it has labeled you as the right vendor, a status you will keep for life, or at least until the next paradigm shift. This is how the graphic arts community responded to Apple's desktop publishing offering, how Wall Street has responded to the trader workstations supplied by Sun and Sybase, how the banking community responded to tandem computers for automated teller machines, and how the film industry is currently responding to Silicon Graphics. These are no fly-by-night commitments. Each can be expected to last a decade or more, a lifetime of loyalty in Silicon Valley years, representing as they do the considered and purposeful action of a group of pragmatist customers ensuring that their industry has the proper infrastructure with the proper support. In short, being in the bowling alley means you have arrived in the mainstream market. You are for real. Your product is endorsed by real customers, not visionaries. And it is obvious to everyone that with loyal customers like these, you are not going to go out of business anytime soon. At the same time, however, your status is not quite that of a fully established company, such as a Compaq, an Intel, or a Novell. These companies are defined as market leaders in the PC, microprocessor, and LAN markets, respectively. Their markets are defined by their products. Yours is not. Instead, it is defined by your customer's application. At this stage, it is a desktop publishing market and not a PC market that Apple has won, an automated teller market and not yet a fault-tolerant computer market for Tandem, an entertainment market and not yet a 3D workstation market for Silicon Graphics. Whenever you see companies expanding by bowling pin strategy, as long as they can continue to find new applications for their sustainable whole product leverage, they are virtually undefeatable. It is just too hard for a competitor to match their whole product's total value, given that market standards and third-party support have already formed around the architecture of the incumbent leader. Conversely, whenever you see companies abandoning their historic sources of whole product leverage in order to enter new markets, they become exceptionally vulnerable. This is because they are so used to having an unfair competitive advantage, they cannot see that they no longer have that protection. The first principle of bowling alley strategy is never attack a segment whose current expenditures on your category of product exceed your own current annual revenue. Or, to put it in the playground vernacular, pick on somebody your own size. Here's why. In the bowling alley, looking forward to the tornado, your primary goal is to get your architecture adopted as the market-leading standard in as many niches as possible. It is a bit like competing in a primary election. Each niche validates your solution, both literally, in the sense that it proves out your whole product, and figuratively, in that it shows another constituency has thrown its support to your standard. The goal is to capture a bandwagon of support, heading into the key nomination period when the tornado market elects its leader. To dominate a segment typically means winning 40% or more of its new business over the past year to 18 months. At that level of success, assuming your closest competitor is well behind you, word of mouth in the marketplace starts spreading the message that you are the market leader. And once that happens, you can expect your share of the following 12 months' sales to increase to well beyond 50%. Pragmatists, more than anything else, want to buy what other pragmatists have bought. Turning to your own company, it is almost impossible to focus 100% of your own sales into any one segment. Indeed, getting, say, 40% from a single segment is quite an accomplishment. So if 40% of your sales equals 40% share of your target segment, then the whole segment must equal in size your annual revenues. This is what we mean by picking on a segment that's your own size. While size sets some limits on strategy, there are other limits as well. If the segment is already well served by another vendor, already as an established market leader, you have no chance of displacing that vendor in this time period. So we must be seeing an underserved segment that is actually not investing heavily at this time, there being no effective solution to its problem, but that would invest heavily if one appeared on the scene. These are the two key bowling pin target criteria then. One, the segment has a compelling reason to buy, and two, the segment is not currently well served by any competitor. Taken together, these two guarantee you an open field. The other key principle in bowling alley strategy is to focus market development efforts on the end user community, not on the technical community. Specifically, you want to enlist the support of the economic buyer, the line executive or manager in the end-user organization who has profit and loss responsibilities for the given function your product serves. Conversely, you should not expect to secure primary sponsorship from the IT professionals, specifically the IT director, responsible for the enterprise's overall infrastructure deployment and maintenance. Here's why. In the bowling alley, you're asking a company to adopt a new paradigm in advance of the rest of the market. This is not in the interests of the IT department. It means extra work for them, and it exposes their mission-critical systems to additional risk. A far better strategy for them is to stay with their current paradigm a while longer, experimenting with the new one offline, but not embracing it. That way, they get the best of both worlds, minimizing disruption and shock while preparing for a future transition. Given this, it is simply bad strategy to ask these technical buyers to champion you at this time. Instead, you must turn to the end user community, and specifically to the economic buyers within it. These people are normally the bosses of the end users you actually want to use your system, and you are specifically seeking the subset that is underserved by the current IT systems in place. Here's how you approach them. You offer to use your innovative product to break the back of some heretofore unsolvable problem that is costing them money. You gain their attention by showing them that this problem is inherent in the current IT infrastructure's paradigm for supporting their end users. You then show them you can solve this problem readily because your new paradigm effectively redesigns the end user's workflow to eliminate the problem's root cause. At the same time, you show how you have thoroughly studied their particular application requirements so that not only do you have the core product necessary to bring off this miracle, you have the whole product as well. And finally, by methodically working through all the elements of this whole product, demonstrating your deep familiarity with their business, you overcome their pragmatist resistance and gain their sponsorship. Now, please note that this same series of offers could have been presented to the technical buyers, who would certainly have understood and appreciated them. It is just that it would not have been in their interest to act on them. Not yet, anyway. Nor, interestingly enough, would it necessarily have been in the interest of the end users who report to the economic buyer. From their point of view, the old paradigm is more familiar and secure. In the short term, with the learning curve required to come up to speed on the new one, they are actually going to be less effective. So they may resist you as well. It is only the economic buyer who has to pay the ongoing cost of the status quo, but who can no longer afford to do so, who can be counted on to be unequivocally supportive of change at this time. This helps explain the success of vertical marketing and the failure of horizontal marketing during the bowling alley. If you market a technology-based product horizontally as globally deployable infrastructure, you do so using terminology that is most familiar to technical buyers. As a consequence, they are the ones to whom the rest of the company cedes decision-making authority. After all, this is their turf. As we have just noted, however, it is bad strategy to play on this turf during the bowling alley. Conversely, if you market your product vertically, focusing on the economic impact of application issues specific to particular business functions in particular industries, then you frame the opportunity in a vocabulary that increases the authority of the economic buyer. Now you have moved the purchase decision onto their turf, which is where you do want to play. To sum up, the bowling alley requires the sponsorship of the economic buyer to overcome the technical buyers and potentially the end users' reluctance to support a new paradigm in advance of the rest of the market. In order to elicit this support, you must frame the buying issues in vocabulary that economic buyers can sponsor. Otherwise, they will defer to the domain expertise of the technical buyer. Taking a vertical marketing approach accomplishes this objective, whereas taking a horizontal approach defeats it. Niche marketing, the discipline that defines the bowling alley, has been badly misunderstood by high-tech firms fixated solely on the tornado. It is, in fact, a compelling strategy for managing the transition from the chasm to the tornado. The most significant reason why high-tech companies have failed to avail themselves of bowling alley strategy is their inability to give up an R&D-based, product-centric perspective and adopt a customer-based, application-centric one. That is what vertical marketing requires, letting yourself be an adjunct to another industry's market in lieu of insisting on being the center of attention. Let us now turn to how to win in the tornado phase of the market. To understand tornado market dynamics, we must shift our view from economic buyers, who hold the key to bowling alley success, and focus instead on the infrastructure or technical buyers, The people in charge of deploying and maintaining our basic support systems. These people are charged with providing reliable and efficient infrastructure by virtue of which we can transact, analyze, monitor, create, communicate, collaborate, and so forth. These systems are always in need of modification, and they are never able to keep up with our end-user demands. Then along comes a new paradigm, a discontinuous innovation that promises to break the IT backlog, delight the end users, and usher in an age of prosperity and competitive advantage. The IT department has heard this before. Of course, it is their responsibility to look at it, which they are interested in doing. But their instincts all say it is too soon to adopt, too soon for the next paradigm shift. They are like career military families who, having just settled down into some reliable routines and relationships, dread having to make yet another move. Yet each year, the new paradigm lurks closer and closer. What are they to do? In a classic human response, they form support groups. IT professionals are expert at networking with each other, even across company and industry boundaries if need be, to discuss the ramifications of the latest technology. These groups are united by a need to answer a single question. Is it time to move yet? As we have already noted, being pragmatists, they will operate like herd animals. And now they have gotten nervous because some unknown scent is in the air. Should they ignore it, or should they stampede? IT executives find themselves continually balancing alpha and beta risk, being defined as any pair of risks that are inversely proportional to each other. Let us say that the alpha risk in this case is the risk of switching too early, and the beta of switching too late. For a long time, alpha far exceeds beta, and the herd is at peace. But as the paradigm shift approaches, so alpha and beta approach each other, creating the instability that precedes a flashpoint change in the marketplace. We have moved, in other words, from the relatively low anxiety state of a tornado watch to that of a tornado warning. The tornado is coming. It's just a question of where it will touch down first. There are three principles operating in conjunction that create the tornado. One, when it is time to move, let us all move together. Pragmatists want to all move at once to minimize the risk of moving either too late or too early. When the herd migrates, the industry must follow, and thus no one gets caught lacking support. Also, whatever protocols get adopted at that time will be the go-forward de facto standards. Two, when we pick the vendor to lead us to the new paradigm, let us all pick the same one. Picking a common vendor, which has the side effect of driving that company to becoming the market leader, ensures a clear reference point for the formation of de facto standards. Three, once the move starts, the sooner we get it over with, the better. The goal in any infrastructure swap out is to collapse the transition time in order to minimize the disruption for end users and the stress of having to maintain parallel infrastructures, not to mention having to build temporary bridges between them. The principle of moving together causes a massive number of new customers to enter the market all at once, swamping the existing system of supply. This in turn causes some pushing and shoving as companies jockey to get their share of vendor attention. That they all want the same product creates a further intensification of demand around a single vendor, along with more pushing and shoving. That they all want to get this over with as soon as possible just drives the thermometer that much higher. And finally, because they feed off each other's behavior, there's a feedback loop operating that whips the entire market up into a frenzy, so that what started out as an orderly migration quickly degenerates into a stampede. The market consequence of this stampede is that virtually overnight, demand dramatically outstrips supply, and a huge backlog of customers appears. The financial implications of this backlog are hard to overstate. For not only does it represent a massive sales opportunity in and of itself, it also represents an even larger follow-on market opportunity. That is, since switching costs in high-tech are so high, once customers settle on a particular vendor, they rarely switch. So each sale gained in a tornado really should be looked at as an annuity. And the total number of sales a company can garner while a tornado is in process sets the limits of their installed base, and thus the boundary conditions on their future revenue from that marketplace. In sum, the tornado is a hugely significant time. It is also a bit confusing for the marketing department. They are used to defining their value to the company as creating demand, but in a tornado, there is no need for this service. So what should the marketing strategy be now? To put it as succinctly as possible, just ship. Don't segment. Don't customize. Don't commit to any special projects. Just ship. Do anything you can to streamline the creation, distribution, installation, and adoption of your whole product. The more friction you can avoid, the more throughput you can achieve. Focus on supply chains and quality to ensure that as you ship, you do not get caught up in returns. Don't focus on the customer, in other words. Focus on yourself. You, not they, are the gating item in this market. In the process of participating in a customer capture game, companies reorganize the marketplace, and power shifts from the service leaders to the product leaders, and eventually to the distribution channels. The entire order of business set up during the bowling alley is blasted away, and a whole new order is created. What is the significance of this new order? To answer this question, we need to look ahead to the close of the tornado period. At that time, a typical market share pattern will indicate that one company has emerged as the dominant market share leader, what Jeff Tarter, software industry analyst and editor of Softletter, likes to call the gorilla. In addition, one or two other companies emerge as strong competitors, albeit clearly subordinate. These companies are the chimpanzees. Finally, a whole lot of other companies have been sucked into the vortex of tornado demand, and these are the monkeys. Now, once the pragmatists start buying one particular company's products en masse instead of another's, the process is self-reinforcing. People in decision theory call this an information cascade. If you are a pragmatist and you have to make a difficult decision, and you know that a number of pragmatists have already faced this decision, and the bulk of them chose A, then you will be very inclined to choose A also. Indeed, the more that A is chosen, the more you will be so inclined, until it is no longer an issue. A has simply become the choice. Thus, from the population seeking gorilla nomination, once the winning candidate has been identified, it is easy to see how it outstrips its fellow competitors quickly. But how come it got picked in the first place and not some other vendor now destined to become a chimp? Simply put, it had the market momentum and the leadership position at the right time. The previous year, it might have been someone else who was in the lead. And if the tornado had started that year, then that company would have been the gorilla. Although there are a number of things a company can do to increase its attractiveness as a gorilla candidate, and still more things it can do to ensure it can meet the demands placed on the gorilla elect, there is still an element of timing and luck in this equation. Once the gorilla is identified, the self-reinforcing mechanisms of tornado purchase decisions ensure that company will get all the sales it can process. These sales shower down in abundance, as if the whole forest were raining bananas. Indeed, there are so many bananas that the gorilla cannot eat them all, so that, full to the point of indigestion, it has to leave some behind where they become food for the chimpanzees. Chimpanzees are candidate gorillas that didn't get picked. We cannot all be the gorilla, but as the saying goes, a rising tide floats all boats, and there is no reason for a chimp not to prosper as well. And even after these companies have had their privileged time at the banana windfall, there are still leftovers for a host of monkeys. Monkeys represent a completely different breed of primate. They come to the market late, only after the tornado has started, with no sunk cost, no commitment to any architecture, no R&D, and no marketing investment, just an opportunistic frame of mind. Their strategy is simple. Clone the gorilla product and sell it cheap. All markets appreciate having a low-cost clone alternative, and as long as demand exceeds supply, there will be plenty of customers for the monkeys as well. By the time the market has stabilized and tornado growth ceases, once, that is, the market moves to Main Street, the market leader is earning a dramatically disproportionate share of the total profits. Moreover, because future revenues and profits are largely a function of selling into one's install base, and because the gorilla has by far the largest install base, it typically enjoys this advantage for the rest of the life of the market. This reflects the magnitude of the prize pragmatist customers confer upon the market leader, which, while not exactly intended, nonetheless acts as a powerful incentive to companies to strive for this status, with the reward to the customer being order and stability in their marketplace. The reason the gorilla's profits are so large is that during the tornado, it has the privilege of setting the market's reference price. This is the price that all the chimpanzees and monkeys must discount below in order to compete successfully against the gorilla. How much they have to discount is a function of how much premium the market places on the gorilla's whole product relative to theirs. At the same time, the gorilla has the highest volume of sales, so it has an equally large advantage in operational costs from economics of scale. Highest price plus lowest cost equals great margins. Every other company must price lower and have a higher cost structure, still garnering good margins perhaps, but not in the same class. The gorilla's fabulous margins, then, are a function not of brilliant marketing, but of how the tornado market's mechanism operates. The essential principles of tornado marketing are 1. Attack the competition ruthlessly. 2. Expand your distribution channel as fast as possible. And 3. Ignore the customer. While the last of these principles may seem a bit startling, we will see in a moment that it falls directly out of the dynamics of tornado marketing. But let us begin with the first item on our list. Why is it so important to attack your competitors during a tornado instead of serve your customers? The answer is that the market expects the gorilla company not just to excel, but to dominate. Indeed, it requires it to do so. If the gorilla shows weakness, if the market wavers in its confidence, if the third parties hedge their allegiances, then the whole point of having a gorilla, which is to set and extend de facto standards as the market moves forward, is undermined. For everyone else in the market who is not the gorilla, focusing on your competitors is still the order of the day. This is because the tornado market is a zero-sum game. Every new customer I win is one you lose, for life. Going forward, that is, they will be part of my installed base, not yours. So you lose access not just to their current revenue, but all future revenue as well. We are setting the boundaries not just for ourselves, but for future generations as well. Under such conditions, all social institutions generate a pecking order, and the higher you can be in it, the better your results will be. Beating a competitor is the only way to move up in the pecking order. Hence, that must be your focus. It is equally important to note here, however, that the tornado is the only time when beating the competition is significant. At no other time, that is, does the market act like a zero-sum game, because in the early market, competition barely exists, except in the sense that one is competing against the old ways, and when you win, nobody else loses. When crossing the chasm and working your way through the bowling alley, your focus is on niches of customers who have been chronically underserved by the existing paradigm. Unwanted before you arrived, they are hardly a great loss when you win them for yourself. Finally, once the tornado is over and the market moves onto Main Street, future growth will come primarily from serving your own install base and not by attacking the base of other companies, it being too disruptive for most customers to switch vendors. The second rule is to expand distribution as fast as possible. In a tornado, customer demand is at its most intense, and if you are not there to take the order, then someone else will get it. It is tempting at this point to say, "So what? I'm fully booked." But remember, it is not just a sale you are losing here. It is a customer for life. The tornado is when you set the limits on the size of the installed base you will serve over the next decade. This means you need to be on every possible shelf you can and have exposure in every possible account. For pragmatist customers, the first freedom in a rapidly shifting market is order and security. That can only come from rallying around a clear market leader. Once the apparent leader-to-be emerges, pragmatists will support that company virtually regardless of how arrogant, unresponsive, or overpriced it is. Thus, the penalty for poor customer satisfaction in a tornado is negligible compared to the rewards for going out and getting the next customer. And that brings us to the third and final lesson. In a tornado, the correct marketing strategy really is to ignore the customer. The reason is that in a tornado, customers are lining up for the hot product. They do not need or want to be courted. The problem is not to create demand. They need and want to be supplied. Anything you do to restrict the throughput of the supply process works against this goal. To be scrupulously accurate, we should say during the tornado, ignore the economic buyer and the end user as customers and focus exclusively on supplying the infrastructure buyer. This buyer has the same motives as you do, rapid deployment of a standard product. By contrast, the economic buyer cares most about return on investment and the end user about the impact on their particular application. Although accelerated deployment of a one-size-fits-all infrastructure during the tornado alienates both the economic buyer and the end user, it does in fact serve the client organization and should be supported. The irony is that to be effective, you must ignore the very customers for whom this is all being done. Having said that, however, you do not, despite the example of any number of market leaders, have to take rudeness to a high art. The same strategy can also be executed with good grace and yet with equally devastating impact on the competition. When it comes to distribution channel strategy, the rule is simple. If you are in a tornado, you simply must not leave any shelf unfilled. If you refuse or neglect to supply any channel with your product, you leave that flank unprotected. To be sure, initially, that shelf may be filled with some inferior clone product. But as the market shifts to lower and lower price points, the volume in the lesser channels begins to dwarf the prestige channels. And it is these same low-end players who now have the advantage. Not covering your low-end flank is a strategic error based on misunderstanding a key tactic of tornado marketing, price point management. Prior to the tornado, markets are not very price elastic. Value propositions are either based on a visionary dream or a niche market's value proposition, and pricing can or should be value-based to optimize for margins and not commodity-based, which means optimizing for market share. Once the tornado is over, on the other hand, markets are going to be very price elastic. This is because during the tornado, the whole product becomes institutionalized and then commoditized so that pricing can be commodity-based, all in the service of rapidly expanding markets and market share. This is because, during the tornado, the whole product becomes institutionalized and then commoditized so that pricing can be commodity-based, all in the service of rapidly expanding markets and market share. The transition from value-based to commodity-based pricing happens during the tornado, and leveraging that transition is key to capturing market share, especially in the tornado's later stages. This is particularly true in retail markets, where hitting the next retail price point creates a burst of buying from customers who heretofore felt the purchase price was too rich for their blood. The point is, the vendor who can first hit the next lower strategic price point gets first crack at a whole new customer base aching to enter the market once prices get down to their level. This creates a burst of new volume, thereby expanding the market share and the future install base of that vendor. If a market leader has already emerged, then the market may wait a while to see if that leader will accommodate the new price point, but it will not wait forever. And if the leader snubs the new price point, then the market will go with the clone. The lesson is clear. Tornado markets will be served. It is never a question of if, it is only a question of who. When market leaders strive to be first to the next price point, they leave precious little room for any competitor to respond. Basically, they are giving themselves first access to the volume commodity market, thereby reinforcing their hold on market share leadership. Competitors must hope for some glitch in the supply chain or make do with the leftover market. Longer term, they must plan to pull out of this tornado and re-enter the bowling alley with some kind of offering that can start a new market outside the leader's dominance. Thus far, we have looked at key shifts in strategy needed for tornado marketing in the areas of target customer, ignore the customer, just ship, distribution, expand as aggressively as possible, pricing, be the first to hit the next lowest price point, and competition, attack it directly and ruthlessly. All of these lessons could equally well have been taught by attending to the practices of Intel and Microsoft. In addition to exemplifying all the rules mentioned, Intel and Microsoft have also taught us how to manage the whole product and partners and allies inside the tornado. The basic principles here are as simple as they are draconian. 1. Recruit partners to create a powerful whole product. 2. Institutionalize this whole product as the market leader. 3. Commoditize the whole product by designing out your partners. In other words, first you design partners in, then you design them out. Designing partners in. The key to winning the bowling alley is to develop niche markets in advance of the general horizontal market by delivering whole products to carefully targeted customers. Microsoft in the CD-ROM market, for example, has carefully nurtured partners, initiating its annual conferences as far back as 1985, some 7 or 8 years before the tornado actually hit. Intel is doing the same thing today with PCMCIA card vendors, parallel computer designers, and video-on-demand entrepreneurs. Second, institutionalize your whole product as the market leader. If and when any of these offerings get swept up toward a tornado, the goal is then to institutionalize your chosen partners and yourself as the core set of market leaders providing the essential solution set. In the case of the DOS tornado, for example, the essential set was Intel's 286 microprocessor, and later its 386, Microsoft's DOS operating system, Lotus 1-2-3 spreadsheet, MicroPro's WordStar word processor, Ashton Tate's DBase database, Seagate's or Connor's hard disk drive, HP's printer, and, to share files and devices, Novell's NetWare network operating system. All of these companies did very, very well during the DOS tornado. Then third, commoditize the whole product by designing out your partners. Once you have won the tornado guerrilla position, then you design these same partners out. Thus, As the industry shifted to support the Windows tornado in 1991, there was a noticeable shift in Microsoft's strategy. In the new pecking order, Intel was still in the middle of the game with its 486 and Pentium microprocessors, as were Seagate and Connor with their disk drives and HP with its printers. But Lotus 1-2-3 and WordPerfect had been designed out by Microsoft. The rationale for designing out partners is not just guerrilla greed. It is an essential part of the natural commoditization of the whole product. In tornado markets, commoditization always follows institutionalization, fusing together in an integrated whole what the market has already come to endorse as the standard set of component parts. The market's goal is to serve the broadest number of customers possible by reducing cost and eliminating distribution friction. The fewer the number of component parts, the fewer the number of suppliers who need to get margins, the lower the whole product can be priced, the more reliably it can be distributed, and the more easily it can be serviced. This commoditization of the whole product is a fundamental force in mass markets. It will happen. The only question is how you will align your strategy with it. Now, as Microsoft moves toward its next operating system tornado, Windows 95 on the client side, and the next release of Windows NT on the server side, it already has its eyes set on designing out Novell. Why do you need a network operating system if you can build all its functionality into both ends of a client-server standard? In similar, albeit longer-term fashion, Microsoft has its eyes on designing out HP's added value with printers via a technology called Microsoft at Work.